So now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jill. And what I'd like to tell you a little, I'd like to tell you that before Jill started helping over shoppers, she held a number of jobs in large corporations. She worked on big IT projects all over the world for Deloitte Touche. For over a decade, she designed and delivered programs for high-performing teams and leaders for international companies. And designing and delivering programs made her uniquely qualified for designing and delivering the Shop Your Wardrobe program. But I think I'm getting a little ahead of myself, and I want to go back to the beginning. So, Jill, what I'd like to ask you is to tell us a little bit about how you got to the point you are now. How did you get from overshopper to someone that is now helping overshoppers, and when did that occur?
Thanks, April. It's great to be on this call, and actually I just see on our Q&A we do have some people from down under. We have someone from New Zealand joining us and hopefully others from around the world. So I'm absolutely delighted to be participating in this call, and thank you for making it happen and for hosting it. My journey probably started way back in childhood. I saw a member of my family, my aunt, on the weekend who tells me my Barbie dolls had the biggest wardrobe she'd ever seen. And so I think that I probably had a real love of clothes and all those kinds of things from an extremely early age. What happened in more recent history was I was running my own facilitation firm, working for very large clients, traveling all over Australia, the region, and a little bit in the United States, doing really interesting work, as you say, for high-performing teams and leaders. And my income was at a fairly high level and my spending was at a high level. And what was also happening was my spending was at an unconscious level. I was continuing to accumulate a great deal of clothes and shoes and other related items without really being aware of how rapid that accumulation was. I knew quite a bit about what suited me and what worked, and you know, I'd studied image and color and style and all those kinds of things. And so I wasn't making very many mistake purchases, as it were, and I wasn't returning an awful lot, but I was really adding an awful lot to my wardrobe fairly quickly. And in the space of a few years, my wardrobe doubled and then tripled in size. And in 2009, my work changed. I started an online company, and a lot of money was, it was flowing, but it was all flowing out. And so my income dropped, but my expenditure didn't. And 2009 was really the year of blinkered thinking for me in many respects. And it wasn't until the end of that year when I'd had a number of experiences that had led to this little quiet voice saying, well, just slow down on your consumption here. And I had been ignoring that voice. And then something happened at the end of that year, and that whisper turned into a shout. And I could no longer avoid those messages that my consumption was starting to spiral out of control. And I didn't understand it. That was the thing that really caught my attention, was I did not understand why I was buying the way that I was. And it actually started to frighten me that this could become quite a serious problem for me. And so on December 15, 2009, I started an extreme personal challenge, which was to have a year without clothes shopping. And the predominant emotion that I felt when I started that was fear, which I didn't understand either. I knew I had to do it. I felt, that this was really important for me to do this. And I didn't know what I would discover. And so I had quite a lot of what felt like negative emotions around starting this, although I knew that it was going to be something that was going to lead me to a better place. And of course, that's ultimately what ended up happening, was that was a very important year for me that not only changed how I think and feel about shopping and my own shopping habits, but it changed what I do with my time and my talents as well.
Wow. That's quite something. What you said spurs a number of questions. One question is, did you know when you started that, when you decided that you weren't going to stop, but you weren't going to shop for a year, were you aware of some of the other people who had done the same thing and had written about it?
No, I was not. And that was what was really quite fascinating for me. And that was one of the things that expanded my own perspective, was discovering those people throughout my year. When I first started, my aperture, if you like, was fairly narrow. I knew I had an issue, and this was a personal journey. This was going to be about me getting on top of and getting a handle of a personal issue. And I very quickly started to do some research and explore and meet other people, and so that was a wonderful discovery to make, not only people who had done similar kinds of things with stopping shopping for periods of time, but meeting people like you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jill and I can't quite figure out how we learned about each other. We both get Google alerts on a variety of terms, but I'm not even sure that was the way. I think somebody in my book club read about Jill somewhere and sent me her name, and I couldn't wait to contact her. In terms of the other people who have not who didn't shop for a year and then wrote about it, I thought it might be of interest for you to know that. There is a woman in Scotland by the name of Alexis Hall who wrote a book called In the Red, The Diary of a Recovering Shopaholic. And, in fact, on my website, there is an interview, a link to an interview that I did with her called Stop the Shopping Insanity. I did three interviews, one with her and one with two other people who had written books. One of them was Nerdine Tesai, who wrote a book called How to Stop Shopping or at Least Cut Down, and one called Spent. And at the moment, remind me who
Avis
is
Cardella.
That's right, Avis Cardella, yes. So Alexis Hall had written In the Red about her year. 2 years before that, a woman by the name of Mary Carlomano had written a book called Give It Up, My Year of Learning to Live Better with Less. And a year before that, a woman by the name of Judith Levine had written a book called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Mm. So this is, and I imagine that none of them knew about each other either.
And my understanding of each of those people is that their shopping restrictions were broad, and mine was very specific. So, you know, Judith, for example, stopped buying everything from takeout coffee to, cutting down her electricity bill, et cetera, whereas mine was really specific to stopping shopping, clothing shopping for a year.
Yeah, that's more what Alexis did. And what Mary did was each month she stopped buying one thing. Like 1 month she didn't take taxis, 1 month she didn't eat chocolate, that kind of thing.
Right.
So other questions that came to my mind were, you said that you really didn't understand why you were buying so much. You also said that you didn't understand why you felt so frightened when you made this decision to stop buying clothes for a year. What have you come to understand about this now?
One of the bigger aha moments for me throughout my year was that for a number of people, and I was one of them, the shopping hits emotional notes, that there are emotional triggers that are a huge part of the shopping landscape. And that was true for me. And it took me a little while to work out what mine might be. And the other interesting thing that's a part of that is recognizing that those emotions are legitimate. It's the method of attempting to have those emotional needs met that led me, and I'm sure others, down a path where not only were those needs not met in any long-term way, but they weren't met in a life-enhancing, spirit-lifting kind of way, but it ended up feeding into a conscious, a vicious cycle that you could never get out of, where, you know, one negative emotional state fed into a behavior that didn't meet that need that circled straight back around to feeling bad again. And so that for me was a really important part of, I guess, getting beneath the surface and doing more than just changing my behavior. I wanted to change beneath the surface. I wanted to feel differently about shopping. I wanted to get rid of what felt like an albatross around my neck. And so for me, recognizing that shopping hit emotional notes was the very first acknowledgement to recognize that it had that component to it, and then the specific emotions that were a part of my, you know, over-shopping was also an important part of being able to address those emotional needs in different ways. And for me, shopping for reward was a really big part of it, and combined with that was almost a sense of entitlement. I've worked hard. I've done something really challenging. I just facilitated a two-day workshop, and the group was really challenging, and it really stretched me, and surely I deserve these, you know, brown suede pumps. And so disconnecting the emotion from the behavior was then, I guess, the third component of being able to have a healthier relationship to shopping, and recognizing that the emotions driving that were not the problem. It was the behavior that wasn't helping me.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's very true. We all have underlying authentic needs that we need to meet. It's a matter of how we meet them, and can we meet them in ways that enhance rather than erode our lives. And the kind of the big categories of need tend to be the need for love and affection, the need to belong, the need for self-esteem, the need for the esteem of other people, and the need for autonomy. And it's important to tease those out, and it sounds like you certainly began to do that. The, you know, the need for acknowledgement was important to you, which is either the need for, you know, love and affection, the need for self-esteem, or really the esteem of other people. That's part of, it sounds like, what played into yours. Now, what about the Jill who had that Barbie collection? When you go all the way back to that, have you given any thought to that? What was, you know, what was that, Jill? What was that, Jill?
One of my key learnings from my year is that it's okay to love clothes. That was a really big takeaway for me, because I've read and seen other people's stories where their, you know, long ban on shopping led them to divesting their wardrobe of most of its contents and stripping back to having, you know, seven items of clothing and those kinds of things. And I honour those authentic journeys that people have that lead them down to that path, but it didn't lead me there. I still love getting dressed up, and I still enjoy clothing, that's a feature of the work that we do in our program. And so that was a really important learning for me, was to recognise that loving getting dressed up and style and all those kinds of things wasn't a problem. It was the constant accumulation to add more and more to the pile that was the problem. And when I trace back my love of clothes and getting dressed up and all those kinds of things, it goes back very, very early. From my earliest memories, I enjoyed playing dress-ups myself, and I had, you know, dolls that I liked to dress up. And I come from a family of stylish women who are all great with colour and looking good, and so, you know, that was a part of my family heritage as well.
Yeah, I think you raise a really important point that we tried to communicate in the marketing messages. This is not about giving up your love of looking good, your love of looking stylish, or your love of clothing. Mm. It's about learning to shop mindfully, and what Jill does so brilliantly is she helps people to shop in their own closet with very specific suggestions, which we will get to a little bit later on the call. Before we do that, I do want to talk a little bit, though, about that year and what it was like for you, because there may be people on this call that make a decision to do something similar, and I think it would be a service to hear a little bit about your experience in the radio interview that you and I, the radio show that you and I were both interviewed for, mm-hmm. you mentioned that there was a point about 3 months into your not shopping year that you backslid and bought something. Can
yes.
you tell us a little about that?
Yes, I can. And I also see we have a question from a caller in New York who's asked me a particular question during my year. So I'll try and fold those two together if that's okay.
Great.
One of the things that I recognized in my year, and it was an insight that I came to further along in my year, it wasn't something I had a grasp on early in the piece, but maybe around month six or so, was that a lot of times when you start an important challenge, we rely a bit on wishing and hoping that we're going to be able to get through it. And wishing and hoping are probably not the most ideal strategies to use. And fortunately, we have at our disposal other things that we can put into place that will help us succeed. And I call it setting yourself up to succeed. And when I was a corporate facilitator, I would talk a lot about that, things that you can do to set yourself up to succeed. And one of the things that I did up until that, around that 3 month moment, was I stayed out of the stores. That was a huge, it's obvious. I know it's obvious, but it was still incredibly effective to just not go into shopping environments, not meet girlfriends in a shopping mall, not meet near my favorite shoe store, just not go into those stores. Because once you see something that's tempting, it's much harder to resist than if you never lay eyes on it in the first place. And so what happened at that 3 month mark was I kind of broke that promise to myself to stay out of the stores, and I went into a store that I knew I liked and previously had yielded up some, you know, good treasure. And lo and behold, I saw something that I liked that, you know, ticked a number of boxes. I have these boxes when I buy things, and it seemed to tick all of them. And so I literally ended up walking out of the store carrying the bag. And it was only when I was getting into the car that it was like I came back to my senses, you know, like I had slipped into neutral somehow while I was in that environment and become unconscious again. And it was only when I was out of that environment that I went, oh, right, and recognized kind of what I'd done. And that was a really, it ended up being an experience that I pulled some positive out of to say to myself, am I committed to this year or am I not? Because if I am, I can't do this to myself. This, if I'm really going to promise myself that I'm going to make a change and I'm going to do, you know, the work that's required to make that change, then I have to stick to that commitment, and I have to honor myself enough that I will do the best I can to set myself up to succeed. And so what I did for the next 3 months was stay out of stores altogether. And then the last 6 months of my year had a slightly different complexion to it as regards going into stores. But that was a really key thing for me, was recognizing the success structures that you can put around yourself that will make it easier to achieve the goals you set for yourself. And it's one thing that I talk to the women who do our program about is set yourself up to succeed. Honor yourself by putting in place those mechanisms that are going to help you achieve what you want to achieve. Can I answer this question that's been
asked?
Of course. The question was, when I stopped shopping for clothes for a year, did I find myself spending more on other things such as vacations or self-care, which is an excellent question and one I was asked an awful lot. I had quite a bit of media attention during my year and I was asked that question quite frequently. The answer is no, I didn't. And one of the reasons that I didn't, I guess, transfer my love of shopping for clothes or my over-shopping for clothes into other areas was because I was tuned into that. Somehow that particular notion came into my consciousness fairly early on, and so I was paying attention to whether or not my consumption would move into another field, you know, whether I buy more throw cushions or, you know, soy candles or self, you know, self-care, you know, massages or, you know, vacations or whatever. So no, I didn't do that. And I think at its heart, that's an interesting observation, that there can be perhaps an assumption that if we stop shopping in one area, we'll start in another area, which might assume we never really get over a compulsion to shop. And I think that's not true. I think we can get over a compulsion to shop. We don't just have to move the pieces on the board, as it were.
I think that's true, and I do want to bring up one issue. People asked you if you were spending more on other things, and you said, no, my consumption didn't go toward another another area of expenditure. But in my experience, it is often the case that when people stop over shopping, they start overeating.
Mm-hmm.
And unless they strengthen the underlying psychological muscles that allow us to tolerate impulses, whether they're impulses for clothing or food, it's very likely that people will transfer this urge to something else, not necessarily spending.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, obviously that didn't happen. And I think it often does happen with people, and it's important for people to realize that if they're not mindful about that, that can happen almost unconsciously.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So what were the biggest difficulties you had during this year?
At the beginning, there was the practical kinds of things of, you know, shopping had become so much a part of my lifestyle in terms of things I did on weekends and even the way I interacted with my husband, you know, when we were out and about, that those kinds of logistical things of arranging my life so that shopping experiences were not so accessible, they were things I had to pay attention to, and they weren't so much difficulties, but I certainly became more aware of how much shopping had become a part of what I did. And so that was something that I had to pay attention to and put some other mechanisms in place and other habits, ways of being in place. The truly challenging moments were the emotional speed bumps that I hit at several points along the way. Claiming this, owning this, taking responsibility for the fact that my shopping had started to spiral out of control and I didn't have any awareness of it, that was a really important big step. And it was just step number one. There were many more steps on the emotional road after that first very important acknowledgement. And I found that a bit of a bumpy road from time to time. And I also came to realize that when I did hit emotional rough patches, was having a bit of a bad day or feeling a little bit upset or frustrated or whatever, how much I would turn to shopping as a go-to activity, as something that provided immediate stimulation and immediate distraction, and that developing other things that made me feel good was a process that took a little bit of time, because in the beginning, nothing really stacked up to shopping. That was the thing that was
mm-hmm.
the most interesting. And so it took
mm-hmm.
a little bit of time, and I really just hung in there with it and said, eventually, you know, self, this will get easier and you'll find other things that you'll enjoy just as much or possibly even more than shopping. I just took it on faith that that would happen, and I continued down that path. And fortunately, that's what happened for me, but it did take some time.
This is a very important point. There are two things I want to say here. I think the capacity to tolerate distress, which is what you're talking about, that you realized that you weren't going to find immediately something that felt as fulfilling or gratifying, and that you were going to have to just tolerate the discomfort, the sadness, the boredom, the loneliness, whatever it was. Knowing that in advance is really important because sometimes we think that we can just find the other thing and we're not going to have to feel bad.
Yeah.
And I think knowing that there are going to be some bad feelings that we're just going to have to deal with rather than resisting the fact that there are going to be bad feelings keeps the sadness, the negative feeling from turning into suffering. You know, we're saying I don't want to feel this, resisting the feeling makes it much worse than just allowing it like every other feeling.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And also recognizing that I was going through a process of change, and because I'd worked in fields helping organisations to deal with change and individuals within organisational structures to deal with individual change. I certainly understood the theory, and I've been through changes in my own life in many ways, but this was a fairly significant change for me, and recognising that change is a process. It is not a single event. It is not like the movies, and that I wasn't going to feel the same way every single day, that if I was feeling bad today, that feeling would shift. And so that's also, I think, an important thing to recognise, is that change is not a single event. It is a process.
Very, very important. Now, one other thing before we go on to your specific program. You said eventually you did find things mm-hmm. that satisfied you, maybe satisfied you in an even deeper way than shopping, and I think sharing some of that might be useful. What were the things that you eventually found?
Some of the things were kind of, you know, big things, like starting this program has actually been a wonderful way to divert a lot of my energy, and I say to people I have fallen deeply in love with this topic, and so that has actually consumed a great deal of my energy and my thought and my talents, and has had its challenges, and it wakes me up in the middle of the night with ideas, and so a lot of my attention has gone into the design and development of the program that we have, and to sharing the message in my own way about that. So that's certainly true. Another thing is that it hasn't been about the fact that I have developed a whole new set of hobbies, you know, joining a choir or, you know, becoming a scrapbook or anything like that. In a way, I have a whole different philosophy on life, if you like. So now one of the things, instead of going out to lunch with my husband and feeling like I need to race through the meal and rushing to the stores, I luxuriate in that moment, and the fact that I'm fortunate enough to have somebody in my life whose company that I enjoy, and so, you know, that experience becomes about being present in that moment rather than rushing through it to get to another place that I thought I wanted to be. And there's been, I guess, more of that kind of approach of not so much projecting myself into future moments where I think I'm going to be happy because I'm going to buy something, or, you know, I used to do a lot of hankering about things. If I didn't buy something, I'd be constantly cogitating and thinking about it, and can I go back and getting it? And I don't have that anymore. And so there's a greater sense of, I guess, presence in my life and in enjoying the space that I am in. As well as just some more day-to-day kinds of things. You know, I cook a little bit more, that style of thing. So there's been some bigger things and some smaller things that I have, turned my time and attention to.
Interesting. You know, it's fascinating because I've only known you for a year, and it's so hard, as I said in one of the emails, to imagine you as somebody who cogitated about these things the way you're describing. Because to me, I experience you as so grounded. And so that's really something that I find pretty remarkable. The other thing that you mentioned, being in the moment, this dissertation that is being written now about the value of mindfulness and mindfulness meditation in curbing compulsive buying behavior is kind of what you described when you're now with Dan and you're really in the moment in that meal. And there are so many ways to develop the capacity for mindfulness.
Yes.
All over the web, there are free courses that people can take. So, you know, I really can't overemphasize the value of something like mindfulness in dealing with a habit like compulsive buying as a way of creating space between impulse and action,
yes,
and really being able to be in the present moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this may be a good time to segue to you telling us something, unless there are any questions that anybody wants to ask right now that relate to Jill's background and Jill's particular journey, knowing that we will go on now to her program. One thing that I will add is that I learned from Jill that at its height, Jill described it, described her compulsive buying behavior as a little out of control. She told me, though, that at one point she had 12 animal print jackets, and she had to turn a room, tell me if this is exactly the way it is, that you had to turn a room in your house into a double closet to accommodate all of your clothes.
Yes, when we moved to the house we're in now, we had 4 bedrooms, and now we have 3, and we converted the double bedroom closest to the master bedroom into a walk-in wardrobe, and I had that space built especially in my, my shoe cupboard. I had over 100 pairs of shoes when I started my challenge, which is an awful lot of shoes for one woman to wear, particularly a woman who works at home wearing, flip-flops many, many days of the year. I measured all of my shoes and it takes up an entire wall and all of that kind of thing. And throughout my year, I got rid of over 50 pairs of shoes. Leaving these 50, I recognize there's still a lot of shoes, but I got rid of over half of my shoes. And, my wardrobe was so full that if I wanted to bring something new in, something had to go out. It was literally stuffed to the gills. That sense of accumulation and, I had furniture in my walk-in wardrobe. You still got furniture in it, but it has less clothing in it than it did when my year started. So I had a lot of clothes.
Good. I did want to make sure that people were aware, that it was as it was, because, that's a lot of stuff.
And it is. And I think it's also important, and it was for me, it was important to acknowledge all of that to myself. That was a really, really important thing to face myself square in the mirror about this. Also, because I went on and started to do the work that I'm now doing, it felt doubly important to be able to claim that, because I think if you're going to put yourself in the position of being able to offer support and empathy to other people, then you have to demonstrate that you come from a place where you truly can understand what other people are experiencing.
Yes, and you really do. So let's segue now to your particular program. Tell us a little about it, how it works, what's involved, what kind of success you've had, et cetera, like that.
Yeah. I wanted to develop a program that was loosely modeled on my own year without clothes shopping, because it had been literally a transformational experience for me, where I felt I had laid down a 10-ton weight. And I didn't realize how heavy it was until I finally put it down. And my own year without clothes shopping was just a phenomenal journey. Because I have a background as a corporate facilitator and I understand about how to design a learning experience that delivers a person from A to B, I combined my own experience, my personal experience and my personal understanding of what my journey was like with the research that I'd done and the people that I'd met, like you and others, and added to that my understanding of how adults learn and how to create a journey. And that's what I wanted to create, was a journey for people where they started at A and they ended up in B, and that I would essentially act as a tour guide to point out, particular things on that journey that may be worthy of their attention and may deliver them something of value to add to their own experience. And what's also important about that metaphor is to recognize that the tour guide doesn't take your journey for you. Only you can take your journey for you. But the tour guide can be very handy to have along. You can miss some things without that person's guidance. They can be a very helpful person to have. And so that was kind of my initial thinking about how to do it. And I also recognized that I wanted it to be program that was delivered over the course of a year as opposed to a single download. There's some really interesting research about the uptake of material that people actually use when they have a single downloadable program info product, and it's very, very low. And so I wanted to deliver the program in a way that was going to have the highest chance possible that people could stick with it. And so something coming into their inbox every week seemed to be a good idea. The program has 12 themes over the 12 months, so it's a program of my own design, but it's based on information and research and the reading that I've done and the talking to other people. And so, you know, we say that there are six pieces of the overshopping puzzle in the model that, that we use, and our program addresses all of those six pieces. And it's specifically geared around clothes shopping, and it's specifically geared for women. And that's not to suggest that men don't have an issue in this area. It's just I had to decide to focus my attention on women or women and men, and I chose to focus just on women. The material we've put together is extremely comprehensive and focuses on different elements when it comes to dealing with over-shopping, and it's designed to be highly experiential. So it's based on the premise that information and knowledge alone doesn't yield long-term change. Oftentimes it doesn't yield any change. It's just information. The only thing that yields change is when you take action and when you do things differently, and so we designed the program to encourage action as much as it's possible to. And so there are 12 themes over the 12 months. Every week there's a weekly lesson that comes into our members' inbox geared around that month's theme. And there's also a resource which they go over to the members only area and they download it that has illustrations and exercises and worksheets in it. And the idea of those is that we make it as easy as possible for you to engage with the material and do the things that are suggested of you, because the principle is that change is possible when you take action, and we try and make that easy. We try and make it's not only what you should do but how you should do it, because sometimes that's the missing piece. You know, we often know what to do, we just don't know how to approach it, or we don't have any sense of confidence that it's going to make any difference if we take these actions. And so I try to remove some of that uncertainty and provide as much reassurance as possible that if you step by step towards your goal, the goal you set for yourself, then you will eventually reach it. And so that's how we've set this program up. And one of the other key important things to recognize is I realized fairly early on in my program design activities that I was not a subject matter expert in all of the areas that I wanted to cover. And that's why I started to look for people who could contribute material where they were more of an expert than I am. And you, April, are one of my most treasured faculty members because you are, you know, a trailblazer and a thought leader and an author in this area. And I feel very honoured that you are a part of our program. And I know that our members gain a lot from your contributions to our program. And so I think that's been one of the other reasons that we've had the success that we have had, is because it isn't just me saying, well, let me tell you more about me and my journey and how you should do what I did. Mm-hmm. We're relying on the expertise of people who are world-class experts in their own right.
Well, Jill, thank you for that. What I'd like, I think people would be interested in hearing some real specifics. You had mentioned, for example, that this, I don't know whether you called them six key elements.
Yeah, six pieces of the overshopping puzzle is what we
okay.
call it.
Okay, so maybe you can say a little about those, and then maybe you can say a little about the specific content areas that you cover, because that I think the beauty of your program is in the specificity.
Yeah, it's very practical. And I think that's also important to recognize. We all have different gifts and things we contribute, and there are some amazing experts in this field. And my contribution really is about integrating the material that is available and putting it together in a really practical step-by-step kind of way. So in terms of the six pieces of the overshopping puzzle, one of them is money, and having a healthier relationship to money, because those of us who overshop often don't have a healthy relationship to money. And one of the other things that I recognized around that is it's not purely about whether you've ended up in credit card debt. That's not the only measure that you can use as to how healthy your relationship is to money. I shudder to think of some of the other things I could have done if I hadn't have been buying so many shoes. And so money is a big piece of the overshopping puzzle, and we focus the entirety of month seven on your relationship to money and how to have a healthier relationship to money with some very practical, specific things that you can do. The emotions and the psychology around overshopping is obviously an incredibly important part of any overshopper's journey back to a healthy relationship to shopping, and we focus months six and eight specifically on that, and a little bit in months six on that. The practical elements about overshopping is something that I think possibly differentiates our program, because one of my key insights was just getting a handle on money and getting a handle on the emotions and psychology of shopping are incredibly important. But if you don't know how to shop strategically, particularly when it comes to clothes, then you can continue to make poor buying decisions because you just don't know what works for you. You don't know what suits you, and you don't know how to consume in a way that gives you what I call a working wardrobe, where every single piece in your wardrobe is paying its rent. Your wardrobe is prime real estate, and you want to make sure that everything you're putting into it is going to pay its rent. And so we have a focus in months 2, 3, 5, and a little bit of month 11 on that particular content. And it's very, very practical, and that's really our shop your wardrobe material that is very specific, because the whole idea of shopping your wardrobe is not a new idea. What a lot of people don't know how to do is, how do I do that? What are some of the specific things that I can do to get, you know, tap into the hidden mileage and magic that is there, that I just don't know how to access it. I know it's there, but I don't have the key. And we provide a number of different keys for people to be able to tap into that and wear more of their wardrobes. Interesting study, most women wear 10 to 20% of their wardrobe, and that's an incredible waste. So that's an element of our program. Another element is the organisational element. You don't wear clothes you can't see. Actually, Neradine, who you mentioned before, who we've featured on our blog, said that she bought an identical black silk shirt because she couldn't see it in her closet. Her closet was just not organised in a way that allowed her to access everything, and so she ended up buying duplicate items, that one in particular, because of that. So we have an emphasis on how to, you know, create a physical space that allows you to see what you have so that you can access it more readily, and certainly you won't end up buying duplicates because you just didn't see what you had. We also have an emphasis on conscious shopping and how to shop consciously, and there are multiple spokes coming off that particular wheel, from the highly practical, you know, so we have in month 11 we have a bonus resource that has 10 keys to being able to, you know, shop strategically, through to some of the emotional elements that underpin conscious shopping, so that you feel good about your shopping before, during and after. And, you know, that's one of the things that was a hallmark of my own shopping, was I didn't think about it before, and during was a bit of a blur, and after I just felt bad. And how you can change that so that you feel good about your shopping in all phases of it. Month one, we spend priming and preparing people for the year ahead. And month 12, which your material, April, is a huge feature of, is about preparing them to go back into the land of shopping so that the changes they've made actually stick and they can you know, feel that those changes have been long-term changes rather than, you know, short-term ones.
I think that the listeners can't help but know what a broad, comprehensive, and huge commitment it is to actually undertake this. I think also it would be hard to not know what a difference doing something like this could make.
Yeah.
Jill, do you think that you could hand us one or two of the keys to tap into the hidden mileage in your wardrobe so people get a real specific idea of something they could do?
Well, I'll share a little bit about the key areas that we focus on, and then I'll give a couple of tips. How's that?
Great.
So in month two of the program, we talk about how to coordinate and mix and match what you already have. Basic assumption that we make is that any woman who's undertaking a year without clothes shopping loves clothes on some level, and she probably has a lot of them. And the people, our members who contribute on our bulletin boards, say that is true. So it seems a fairly reasonable assumption to say, let's make use of that love of your clothes rather than pretend it doesn't exist or in some way try to suppress that or try to beat that out of you. Let's actually make use of it. Let's use it as a resource. And so month two, we spend exploring your wardrobe from the perspective of how to get more out of it through mixing and matching, through creating capsules, through upstyling, through to how to being able to create a capsule wardrobe for special occasion wear. How many people have bought an outfit for one special occasion that cost them hundreds and hundreds of dollars and they only bought once? It's an incredible waste. And so that's what month two is about. Month three is about how to dress for your particular personality. We have a process that we take people through of understanding what your particular personality is, which, of course, you can spend your entire life trying to discover. But we distill it down into some very usable tools and then how to apply that to your own wardrobe so that you're always dressing in a way that makes you feel like you. One of the reasons that women who have lots of clothes feel they have nothing to wear is because they feel they have nothing they love to wear. And you can remove that frustration when you understand what makes you feel like you. Clothes form an endless feedback loop in terms of how we feel about ourselves, and clothes express something and inform something about who we are. And if you can tap into that in a way that makes you feel like yourself, you can then forget about clothes and focus on other more important things. Month five of the program, we focus on color and style and how to understand those as they apply to your particular body, and that's a huge part of the shopping strategically kind of puzzle.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I see we have 9 minutes left on the call,
yes.
And I think people are now really getting a flavor of the specifics. I don't know whether you wanted to give a tip or two before we answer the questions that have come in.
Well, I'll say this. If people, once you send out the link, if people do sign up for my free stuff, there's heaps of tips in there that you can get
Great.
For free. And so, I give away a lot of information for free, as well as obviously if you join the program, well, then you get that, magnified 100-fold. So there's lots of information people can access once they get the
Great.
Link, so if that helps.
It absolutely helps. Okay. So we have a question that has come in that I wanted to pose to you, or will. People are asking me what I want for Christmas, but I already have so much stuff. From my husband, I can ask for theater tickets. But what about others who will buy a smaller gift? Also, family members are asking what they should get for my daughter. What do you suggest for the kid who already has lots of stuff?
Mm.
So there are really two questions here. Other people than this questioner's husband who will buy smaller gifts, and what to suggest for people to get for her daughter. I wrote a piece called Have a Good, Not a Goods Holiday. Give experiences mm-hmm. rather than things.
Yeah.
And that's something that I will also enclose a link to in our post-call email. And my answer to that question, and Jill, I want to hear yours too, is that smaller gift, that if you don't want a thing, you can certainly ask the gift giver to do something like maybe buy 3 ducks for a family in Cambodia through the Heifer Project, or any of a variety of interesting gifts like this, especially for your daughter, who might find it fascinating to see that she gave a rabbit to a family in Ghana. So those are some possibilities. Jill, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, I do. I think the experience thing is really important. This year, my husband and I are not giving each other Christmas gifts. We're going to have a stand-up paddling lesson together, which, of course, you can have when you live in Australia at Christmas time because it's stinking hot in summer here. And we're going to spend a day at a hydrotherapy, an hour at a hydrotherapy pool. So we're going to give each other an experience that we can have together. And I think that that's a nice idea. And I think this whole idea of having a tree that has is just full of gifts at the bottom of it is also something that it's a good idea to start disconnecting yourself from. That's what Christmas means. It means a tree that has all this stuff stuck under it. And if you are going to give a gift, I think the idea of giving one gift that the person really wants as opposed to a handful of stuff just to sort of fill up the space is a much better idea. So if you are going to give a gift, that would be my suggestion. And I just love that idea of helping somebody else at Christmas time. That, I mean, as a way of making yourself feel good and doing something worthwhile, it really can't be beaten.
Yes, it's true. Generosity is the best antidote to compulsive buying that there is.
Yeah, exactly. Help somebody else.
Yeah. I wanted to share something, but we have 5 minutes left on the call, so if anybody else has a question, now's the time. In terms of the point that I made before that Jill brought up about learning to tolerate discomfort and what I said about just accepting the feeling, there's a poem that I love that I wanted to share with you that speaks to this issue. It's called The Guest House, written by a 12th century Sufi philosopher called Rumi. And this is the poem. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. I love that poem. And sometimes when I am having a negative feeling, I actually imagine a chair across from me, putting that feeling in the chair and talking to it as a way of disidentifying some from that. And I think I've been told by people I've worked with that really has worked very well.
Yes.
And the other thing that I want to say before I give Jill a chance to say goodbye to you is the idea that you can never get enough of what you don't really need. So that if what you really need is a circle of loved ones around you, 20 pairs of black boots is never going to do that. The importance of identifying what it is you really need and finding a way to get that is really important.
Yeah, I agree.
So, Jill, we've got 2 minutes left. I don't see that any other questions have come up. And if you've got questions that come up after the end of the teleseminar, send them to us at info@shopaholicnomore.com, and we will most certainly answer them. So we've got a couple of minutes, Jill. What would you like to say in closing?
Two things. One is, I know what a 10-ton weight it is to have a compulsion to shop. I've had that experience, and I know what a burden that it is. And even if you're not quite aware of how heavy it is, but you know you've got it, I understand what that feeling is like. And I also know the enormous relief that it is to let go of that burden. and how much you get your life back. And it is possible to do that. So that's the first thing that I want to say is I really do get it. I really do understand it. I have nothing but empathy and admiration for anybody who undertakes to rid themselves of a problem like this. Mm. The second thing is that your life is far too important to be spent. Your life really should be lived, and it's life is not to be found in the more or the accumulation of more things. And I feel that I can say that in a non-preachy kind of way as someone who has accumulated a lot of stuff, who has spent a lot of time in a mall. So, I'm still living in the world. I'm not on a mountaintop, meditating in solitude. That there is so much of life to be enjoyed when you tap into it and you see your life as something precious to be lived and not to be spent.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to end.
Mm-hmm. We do have some questions here that we haven't gotten to, but we will respond to those. For those who have sent them in, we'll do that via email, and we will do it anonymously. A few people have requested anonymity in responses, and we will get to those over the next few days. We're going to do that, April?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
Well, thank you all for being on the call. It's really been a pleasure. I'm sorry that because there were so many people on the call, we weren't able to hear your voices. But thank you for being on the call, for asking your questions, and please know that we're available.
Mm.
You will be getting by Thursday a follow-up email with all the things that we said on the call would be there. And please do take us at our word. We will be happy to answer your questions.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. Certainly when you send out the link to my site, I have a FAQ page which has a ton of frequently asked questions. So things that aren't addressed there, we might have some answers to in places like that.
And we wish you a good, not a goods holiday. And I think we're going to need to say goodnight, because if the teleseminar hasn't ended already, it's going to in about 5 seconds.
Okay. Thank you, Agatha.
Thank you, Jill.
Okay. Bye,
good night,
everyone.